Good morning, folks. It's 9:08 and a half. October 11th, a Wednesday. 70 degrees in our studio. I almost said outside. It's 41 outside. Had my first morning to scrape the windshield. That's right, there was some frost out there. And, you know, atmospheric conditions, meteorology, it's all part of what we're going to talk about today, right here on the Party Line. Joining us live this morning, Ryan Foote. And Ryan's been on the show, although, frankly, my memory, I can't remember. Perhaps it was 10 years ago even. But Ryan is a professor of meteorology. And Ryan, where'd you hail from?
Good morning. It's great to be here. I'm from originally Lakeview, Ohio, which is in northwest central Ohio. If you were to take 33 and go up to Columbus, then continue on 33 about another hour and 15 minutes beyond Columbus, you'd come into my parents' house. It's in the area of Indian Lake, which is a popular fishing and camping recreational area as well.
As a kid, I spent some time on Indian Lake and liked it, too. There was a neat restaurant there, too, of some kind. But anyway, my parents enjoyed it. Think back. What kind of extracurricular activities were you interested in while you were growing up? You know, did you participate in athletics? Did you participate in different special organizations at the high school? Whatever.
Yeah, I ran track for a year. I was a distance runner. And so I liked it, but in track, you basically, in a distance, run around in circles and don't, you know, basically end up in the same place that you started.
Right.
And so it's not very exciting. And I wasn't the best at it. I was not the worst, but I wasn't the best. And so I pursued some other things in high school and got into science club and music. And so eventually became the president of both of those organizations. I was president of the science club and president of our marching band. Picked up a lot of different instruments in high school and always thought if I didn't make it in meteorology, that I could always do a career in music education because I loved playing music, writing music, different instruments, and performing with other people. And so I thought, you know, music could be a good background thing for me, and now it's still a fun hobby. I still play a lot of music and work in that area.
I can't let that topic go. I'm going to have to ask a few more questions.
Great.
So your principal instrument was what?
I played the trombone mostly through high school, so that was my main instrument. But by the end of high school, I was playing about four different instruments in the band, including saxophone, clarinet, melodic percussion. So I had quite a different array of things. And then in the background, I played piano. And piano is still probably the instrument that I play the most.
Neat. Well, that's a whole nother topic for a whole nother show. But today we're going to talk about meteorology. So, where along the way did that zero in for you?
I kind of knew that I loved science early on in my life. I was always fascinated by, you know, the natural world around me and what was going on, and always was curious to know not just what I was seeing, but why things were happening the way they were happening. Most of my meteorology students in my classes came into meteorology because of severe weather. They saw a tornado or a severe thunderstorm or hail, and they were drawn into the field and loved it. My story is quite different. It's actually a lot easier. I just loved watching clouds. I would lay in my yard. It's rural Ohio, and you had plenty of views of great clouds. You could see out into the horizon and across the fields and see storms build and develop. And I just loved watching that thing. I just loved watching clouds grow and build and move across the sky, even on clear days when a cloud would just suddenly pop into the sky. I was fascinated with that. And so it was just small little things that drew me into the field. And as I grew into it more, I learned more about different areas, and ultimately my path in meteorology changed several times.
Well, you know, meteorology, it can mean so many things to so many different people. But I'd like to hear your definition. Meteorology.
Yeah, it's a good question. Meteorology, to me, would really just mean the study of the weather. So you can do that as a forecaster and, you know, study it in terms of like predicting what would happen today and into the future. Or you can get into it in a research sort of way, studying patterns across a region, how they're changing, why they're changing, and understand that sort of thing, which almost gets into more of climate and climatology, but still is focused on weather patterns. So it's the study of weather. I was trained more broadly in atmospheric sciences, so that involves not only, you know, day-to-day weather patterns, but things like climate and climate change, patterns in the ocean as well. In graduate school, I got to studying the ice and learning about how ice was changing across the world as well. So it's a really broader training than just, you know, weather patterns from day to day.
Would you say that meteorology is a complicated subject?
Yes, I would. Maybe I'm a little biased, but I have to work with students in the university a lot who come in loving weather and don't realize that that career involves a full year of calculus, a course in differential equations, and then a full year of calculus-based physics. And so there's a lot of extra science that you're doing to prepare yourself for a career, even a career in broadcast where you're on TV and probably will never use those equations or that theory on air, but you certainly have that underpinning in your knowledge in the classes.
And that's so, just, I'm sorry, didn't mean to interrupt, but this just assumes someone out there doesn't know what calculus is.
Yeah.
Or the mathematical equations in the terms form. Just do the best you can to give us a simple reason why those are imposed in weather and meteorology.
Yeah. So in meteorology, we're interested in how things are changing. And in calculus, that's called a derivative. It's looking at a rate of change of some process or variable through time. That's what we look at in meteorology. So essentially, we're doing derivatives all the time. We're doing calculus by looking at how is the temperature going to change? How is the pressure going to change? How are the winds going to change? These are all really calculus problems at the heart. They also are underlying into physics, because physics is explaining the forces that cause these changes, the accelerations that result when things get out of balance, and how things quickly change in some cases and in some cases not. And so they're like laws of like force equals mass times acceleration, the Newton's laws that really go into understanding why things are changing. So it's, you know, driven really by these fundamental properties in math and physics that you don't always appreciate when you're watching things change. But then when you get into the coursework, you realize, okay, this is actually why things are changing.
So much time has passed in my life. So there's things that I've learned and since forgotten. But the Earth rotates. It has an axis. A-X-I-S. I said that right.
That's right.
So at these rotational points, one way north, one way south, those Antarctica, and what's the other one?
The Arctic Ocean, the North Pole, Greenland.
Yeah. Now, there are land masses there. And I find that, or it's my recollection, that meteorologists love to focus on those poles and, you know, Antarctica and all this sort of thing. Why is that?
I think there's a lot of different weather patterns that you would experience in those regions. And certainly if you look at change in things, like change in temperature, loss of ice, those are happening more markedly in the polar regions than they are here in the mid-latitudes where we are in Ohio. So some of the greatest change that we're experiencing is happening in both polar regions. And so people want to study that change and know why it's happening, what it might mean for the rest of the globe. And how it could impact people that are even living in places like Ohio.
Now, here in Athens, we have a facility called Scalia Laboratory, or Laboratory, if you prefer. It is, it studies the weather primarily, yes?
Yes.
Now, when I think of an observatory, I often think of a telescope as well. Does Scalia have a telescope?
We don't. We have a weather tower that sits on West State Street. It's out by the driving range behind the biochemistry building there in an open area. It's a 10-meter tall tower, so you have, it's hard to miss. If you're out there by the student farm or the West State Street Community Gardens, you'd see it. And on that, we have multiple instruments that are continuously measuring various properties of the weather.
Yeah.
And so that's our main suite of instruments. It's actually not even inside the lab. It's out there on campus. And we connect to that weather tower all the time, and it feeds into our lab. And then we create graphs to visualize the weather and how it's been changing over the last day.
Now, I'm certain that, you know, you can jump on your laptop or whatever right now, and if you have one in front of you, and be observing what it's measuring. Can you do it with your phone too?
Yes, our lab has a website that is mobile friendly, and so you can get all of our meteorological data and information from the weather tower on that website on your phone.
When we say you can, does that mean the public is invited to do so?
Absolutely, yeah. Okay. In addition to like the data, we also provide weather forecasts. I would encourage you to look at those weather forecasts, because unlike many of the weather forecasts that you might get on your phone app or any other your weather information places, our forecasts are done for local conditions. We mm-hmm. have local knowledge, local expertise. A lot of times the forecasts that you get on weather apps or other weather websites are done for a larger region without people locally with the local knowledge. And so sure. we're training students to learn about the conditions here in Athens and in Southeast Ohio and use that knowledge to tailor a forecast specifically for this region.
Well, it may be a complicated answer to my question, but if I wanted to do it, or if anybody listening wanted to tie into that and observe the readings, is it a complicated address?
Oh, no, it's just scalialab.com. So scalialab.com. And that'll take you to our website. For those that don't have internet connectivity, we also have a phone hotline that we've been running for over 40 years, 740-593-1717. You can call into that phone hotline and get your forecast anytime. It's a student that reads into the phone hotline there and will give you your forecast.
But using the scalialab.com address, what is one likely to have available to them?
Yeah, quite a bit of information. You can see the forecast there really quickly. You can get our observations, just the current observations. And then if you want to go into a different page, you can get detailed information about those observations, including the conditions over the last, 3 days, if you want to see how the weather's changed recently. You can also learn more about us. You can see who your forecaster is. These are students that are being trained in meteorology. Some of them are seasoned and are really good at forecasting. They've been forecasting for many years. We have them in paid positions in our lab, and they forecast quite regularly. And then we have some students, this is their first semester of forecasting, and so they're learning. Their forecast will get better as the semester goes on, as they learn more and more. But you can read about them. You can see who that student is, what their interests are in meteorology, what other passions they may have outside of meteorology. And so you can get a kind of personal connection with your forecaster that you wouldn't have in other kind of sites. So yeah, there's a lot of information I think that you can get. You can also learn about what we're doing as a lab in the community and with students, our affiliated student organization. You can learn information about that as well.
I'm only guessing, but I'll go anyway. I am inclined to think there are many campuses across the nation who have such a facility. And why should the Scalia Lab be paid attention to versus the Ohio State Lab or the University of Cincinnati lab or whatever?
Actually, meteorology is not a common area at most universities. Really? In the state of Ohio, it's just us in Ohio State.
You're kidding.
No. And in the geographic region, we're the only one in Southeast Ohio, Southwest Pennsylvania, and all of West Virginia that has a meteorology major. So we kind of are the hub in this area for student learning
in like meteorology. So like the TV stations in Huntington are watching you guys?
I mean, they have their own data as well. So, yeah. Like, you know, all these TV stations have a weather station locally as well. Some of them have, you know, their own radar as well. So they have their own data. But in terms of universities, we're the only one in this geographic region. And I would even go further to say Ohio State's a great program. I did my master's and PhD there, and I learned a lot. But their weather forecasting lab is not a community-centered lab like ours is.
Where is it located? I'm a Worthington guy, so I'm curious.
So it's on the Ohio State campus in Derby Hall.
Okay.
It's part of the geography department there.
I know where it is.
And their lab is mostly trained on students. So it's really for campus and getting forecasts out for the campus community that aren't often used by the public. It's in a big city, so it kind of gets lost in the noise a little bit with lots of other places to get weather information. Whereas here, we are primarily a community-driven laboratory. We want to issue forecasts, yes, to train students, yes, to help them grow as scientists and forecasters, but ultimately to serve the community. We want people to use our weather forecasts for planning and for learning about what might happen for the weather. We want them to use our weather data for their own knowledge. We get requests all the time from people in the Athens Garden Club, for people that are looking at conditions and wanting to know how much rain we had. And we provide them with that information so that they can use it for whatever benefit they may have.
Now, laboratory, observatory, you know, those terms can get a little mixed up. And I think most of my experience has been in an observatory. And so often those have to be located in places where there's not a whole lot of light pollution and stuff like that. Now, Ohio University does have an observatory, right?
They have different ones, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. There's and so they tend to be away from the campus where there's minimal light pollution. But for meteorological purposes, light is not a factor.
Correct.
You're measuring, well, temperature, humidity. Go on with that list.
Pressure, wind, soil moisture. We also measure radiation from the sky or from the sun and from the earth.
And radiation, I mean, radiation is always a concerning term, right? Because you think of nuclear radiation.
Right.
Okay, but radiation.
This is just energy from the sun. It's what drives all weather, ultimately. It's what makes things warmer or colder. So we're measuring the component of radiation coming down from the sun that makes daytime temperatures warm. And at night, we measure the component of radiation. Radiation is just energy that's invisible. It travels in what we call radiant waves. So it's not visible to the naked eye. It's things that are a function of the temperature of that surface. And so we measure the radiation also at night coming from the earth or from clouds above us.
My buddy, the lady I'm engaged or involved with, just returned from Texas. She had about a month down there helping her daughter after a surgery. The point is 114 degrees. Livestock, people, everything were, you know, really kind of struggling. I know that's happened in the past, but I don't recall it. But this summer, there's been some real weather oddities, right?
Yeah, it's been a really warm summer in the South for sure, and also very dry. So in the combination of, like, you know, 100 degree days many times throughout the summer, they had very little rain. And so it led them into a pretty strong drought with a deficit in precipitation. And so it's been a really rough, yeah, summer for places like Texas or other states in the South.
Well, you know, what is there anything about the future of weather that is worrisome?
It's a good question. I think we move into more like the climate and how the climate is changing to look at that more in detail. You know, in the U.S., I think we're concerned about changes in hurricanes, how they might become more frequent or more severe, or at least lead to more flooding as sea level rises and storm surge pushes waters farther inland. I think that's a concern that we're looking at. There's conditions, and there's a lot of debate and science still going on about the potential for more severe weather as the world warms. So what could that look like? It could look like, you know, getting our precipitation rather than in a steady sort of conditions like we'll have over this next coming weekend, rather than getting, you know, steady rains, we'll get rain that'll happen in a heavier storm. So what that means is that most of that rain doesn't get absorbed by the ground and the soils. It just rains too quickly, and a lot of it becomes runoff, and it can lead to inland flooding or river flooding, flash flooding events. As that happens, we seem to have pretty good confidence in that being a case in the future. But there's also concerns that maybe the atmosphere would be more conditioned or more primed to lead to other kinds of severe weather, including more dangerous tornadoes or more storms with frequent lightning or stronger hailstorms. Those things are an area of active research and debate. They're not a clear example of those because they happen on very short time scales, but there's studies that suggest that the atmosphere being warmer could hold more moisture and fuel those kinds of conditions more often.
All right, so we are blessed. Well, that's a little saucy term, but we are very fortunate to have such a lab on our campus. And it's well-equipped, and it's had a history of being really well-respected. Now, what is something that you don't have that you'd love to add to the facility?
Well, in the near future, we're going to be moving back into our Clippinger Laboratory. We're currently housed in Lindley Hall as Clippinger is being renovated. And with support from Higher University 1804 funds, we are really excited to have new equipment coming into the new facility.
Now, just refresh my memory. Clippinger is which building?
It is across the way from the Ping Recreation Center.
Okay.
So it's on South Campus.
Okay. And then Artex just up the hill a little ways.
Yeah, Artex is more located closer to uptown Athens.
Yeah. And I just saw a mother and a baby doe walking right by the entrance to Artex. I couldn't believe it, right in the middle of town.
Yes.
Oh, well, that's not important.
They're all over campus right now.
Are they really? That's,
yes.
That's kind of cool. And people would stop and kind of talk to it. Well, anyway. Okay, back to our topic. So these different labs that exist, observatories, if you will, or I'll just stay with the word lab, they all have different functions, right?
Absolutely.
So just list some of those functions.
Well, I mean, in addition to the forecasting that we do in our lab, it's also a teaching facility. We teach classes in there on forecasting and provide students training on how to learn to use information from weather models and to tune them to our area. So now, it's a teaching area.
A lab, when I think of a lab, I think of a domed thing, you know. But they don't have to be that, do they?
No, ours is mostly like a computer lab, a computer space where...
Just a room.
It's a room where every student every desk has a computer on it, and so that students can access information, write reports, write weather forecasts on their computers while looking at information. We do have separate computers that have two screens so that they can see all the weather data and information they want to look at, and then write it up onto a report on a separate screen so that they can be more efficient in what they're doing.
Mm-hmm.
But in addition to the teaching spot, we also do a lot of research through the lab. We have students that will look at conditions and write case studies on them. We had an interesting event in August here on August 12th. You may be aware that we had a tornado move through Athens County. It was just outside of the city of Athens, actually really close to my neighborhood in Hocking Hills, and move along those areas. Thankfully, it didn't damage a lot of property. It took down some trees, ripped off a few things in some houses, but it didn't. There were no fatalities or large damage done with that tornado, but we had students that were taking pictures and videos of the tornado from a safe distance, and then did a case study analysis of what happened in that thing that we put on our website. So we have that kind of research side to it. In addition, students that work with me in research will often use the laboratory as an area to do coding and data analysis to understand some of the questions that we're looking at.
Ryan, Ohio State was where you had most of your undergrad work, right?
Graduate work, master's graduate and PhD.
Okay, yep. Well, your undergrad was where?
It was in Creighton University in Omaha, yes. Nebraska.
Yeah. How is it that today you are the director of the Scalia Lab? How'd that all come about?
When I finished my PhD, I did a postdoc for 2 years in Colorado at a climate center, the Earth System Research Laboratory in Boulder, Colorado. And I was finishing up my 2-year postdoc, and I was on the job market for positions in academia. And the timing just worked out luckily that Ohio University in my own home state was hiring. Again, there's not many meteorology schools, so you kind of have to be open to going anywhere when you're on the job market. It's unlikely that you'll land a job in your home state. Mm-hmm. And it worked out that Ohio University was hiring. Their previous director of the lab wanted to step down from that position and just teach. And so it was a kind of a joint sort of offer to get to teach meteorology classes and direct this laboratory. And I applied and interviewed, and thankfully was selected to have a career here at Ohio University.
That's cool. But on the other hand, I'm going to ask a maybe lousy question. Boulder, Colorado. I went to school in Colorado and Wyoming. Some. I always make fun of Wyoming, though. The weather.
Beautiful. Yeah.
And extreme differences. And so was it kind of a letdown to come to Ohio where the weather is fairly, you know what I'm trying to say.
Yeah, yeah. It's a very different weather for sure. And of course, you don't have the beautiful mountains to look at and go hiking in, or if you like skiing.
Yeah,
my family is from Ohio, and that was a big driver to come back to the state of Ohio.
I'm sorry, I interrupted you, but
I was just saying that one of the big factors of me coming back to Ohio wasn't so much the weather. This is a great opportunity in this position, so it was a good move for me professionally. But also, my family is from Ohio. My parents still live in Lakeview, and so we're rather than being over 30 hours or so by car from them, we're now within 3 hours from them. So it's a lot easier. We had just started a family, and so we had they had grandkids, and we wanted them to be involved and see their grandkids more often. And so there's a personal reason as well to come back to Ohio. Mm-hmm. Having grown up in Ohio, I was well aware of, especially like the winters and how difficult they can be to get through compared to Colorado, where you have a lot of sunshine in the winter. Here, we have a lot of clouds and more storms. It was that was something I was well aware of. I was getting into, but ultimately, it was the right kind of move for me to come back here. And actually, I did even turn down an interview for a position in Boulder at a university there because I had an offer here at Ohio University. And so, it was a leading choice for me all along.
Well, between Wyoming and Ohio, I think I would have picked Ohio, but that's just me making a joke about my Wyoming experience. Okay, so when you look at your bio, there's some things. What is the Admonson Bellinghausen Sees Low? That topic, what is that?
Yeah. So I had a grant from the National Science Foundation. I do my research on Antarctica. I've been fortunate enough to be down to the continent 3 times as a graduate student, fell in love with it. And
wait,
the Amundsen Bellinghausen
fell in love with it.
Yes.
Okay, that's interesting.
Fell in love. I fell in love with the beauty. I fell in love with the curiosity of the place that so few people have been to that we didn't know enough about scientifically yet. And I guess it's my curiosity that drove me to learning and wanting to know more about it. And this project on the Amundsen Bellinghausen Sees Low, which now has been shortened to just the Amundsen Sea Low, is an interesting one because it was trying to answer some questions that we didn't know at the time. The area called West Antarctica, which is basically almost straight south of South America, that region of Antarctica is warming and melting the most of any part in Antarctica. Mm-hmm. And we didn't know particularly why it was doing that at the time. And I'm coming from the atmosphere side of things rather than the ice side of things. And we knew a little bit about the atmospheric circulation, the winds, just around West Antarctica. And so this was a project to understand those winds better. It turns out that there's a low-pressure system that sits there almost all year. It moves around, it strengthens and changes with the seasons, of course, but it's kind of like the Aleutian Low or the Icelandic Low in the Northern Hemisphere you may have heard of near Alaska or near Iceland. This one is off the coast of West Antarctica, and we didn't know how it was connected to what was going on with the warming and the ice melt. And so this was a project to kind of look at that connection, understand what role might it play in the changes that we're seeing across the ice sheet.
Now, forgive me, it's not a big place. If it melted, so what? Now react to that.
It's a kind of misconception. It looks like it's a small place just because of the way it's projected onto a map or onto the globe. Antarctica itself is 1.5 times the size of the contiguous U.S., so it's fairly large, really. It's much bigger than our country.
How thick might it be?
Yeah, so the ice sheet gets to be over 10,000 feet in its highest places. It's roughly 3 miles of ice below you, and it's high, 2.5 to 3 miles of ice.
So if it did melt, it could cause a real change in the elevations of the oceans.
Absolutely. Antarctica stores the most fresh water of any place on the planet, and that ice, if it were to melt, could raise sea level by, you know, tens of meters. We're not talking like just, you know, a few inches here or a foot there. It's, you know, looking over 30, 40, 50 feet, depending on what parts of it would melt. The parts that we're most worried about melting right now,
so
West Antarctica.
My former home in Honolulu would be underwater.
The higher elevations, like the mountains, would be okay, but the coastal regions for sure, Honolulu would be threatened.
Yeah. Okay, so I get it now, but I did not realize it could have that severe an effect.
Yes.
Okay, now, let's talk about global warming. We hear that over and over and over again, but put it in real terms for us.
Yeah, I think global warming is one part of the whole complex picture. So global warming would tell us that temperatures, when averaged across the entire Earth, are going up, they're warming. And that happens over a long time period, right? At least 30 years. Typically, we're looking at patterns over, you know, 100 years and seeing that warming trend. But I say it's one part of it because there's many other things that are also changing in response to that warming. We're having ice being lost in Antarctica or Greenland. We're having species change. They're migrating towards the poles to colder climates, and we can track their movement. Some species are changing their breeding patterns in adaptation to the warming. Some plants are flowering at different times of the year. We've seen shifts in those as well. So it's much more than just the temperatures. It's this whole connected climate, you know, Earth system that's changing in response to it. There's many things that you can look at to understand this bigger change.
The term meteorology. I think of meteors as being in the sky. Some are stationary. Some have certain degrees of movement. Why do meteors affect weather?
So not the space-borne meteors that would be out in space and may come into the atmosphere. We call these ones hydrometeors. It's basically water in its various forms coming to Earth. So whether it's rain, that's a form of a meteor in some way. It's an object falling from the sky and making contact with the Earth. It can also be in the frozen state, whether that's hail or snow. These are all we call hydrometeors, and they're water-based meteors that are coming down into the Earth. And so meteorology has its connections in that term with you know, falling objects from the sky related to weather.
Okay. Now, you know, weather, we have weather always, as long as there's been life, and maybe longer. What are some recent weather events that have caused you to raise an eyebrow?
I think, you know, this summer not only was warm for the U.S. South, but it was warm for most of the world. And so seeing, you know, continued warm events year after year drives concern to me because it makes me realize that there's something bigger that's changing, and it's not just a local thing. It's happening at a large global scale. I think, you know, sea level rise is something that I'm really worried about myself, not because, you know, here in Ohio we have to worry about, you know, being washed away into the ocean. The Appalachian Mountains will protect us from that. But because of its global scale, much of the largest cities in the world, including like New York and Los Angeles for us here in the United States, are on the coast. Mm-hmm. And they're the people that are going to be impacted by sea level rise. They'll have a lot more flooding events in the city. There will often be people that may have to be displaced. Their homes would be closer to the ocean, more frequent flooding, maybe even like coastal erosion and beach erosion that could cause their homes to be unsafe. And so they may have to migrate and change. We call those people climate refugees. And so my concern is, like, you know, what's going to happen to all these people that are displaced? What's going to happen to the large population? Some of them not very developed, some of them like in Bangladesh, that whole country is really close to sea level and can have just a few storms like a tropical cyclone move through and cause catastrophic widespread flooding that can lead to a lot of loss of life. And so those are the kinds of things that I'm concerned about most because of the sheer number of people that it would affect.
Okay, so global climate change. Again, we hear about it so often. But, you know, what the hell? I'm a human. I'm not going to live, you know, more than 100 years. So what happens during 100 years can be really small. But when you add a number of lifetimes together, it can be big. So I don't know why I'm saying all of this. Is it caused by humans, climate change?
The majority of climate change cannot be explained without human linkages. So yes, in a simple answer.
So what am I doing wrong?
I wouldn't blame any individual for climate change.
Well, of course not. What am I, an American living person on the earth, doing wrong?
The biggest problem comes down to greenhouse gases. Greenhouse gases are heat-trapping gases that exist in the atmosphere of the Earth above us. The main one that we monitor is carbon dioxide. There are other smaller ones that still contribute to a warming, but carbon dioxide is the most abundant, and basically the other ones can get canceled out by some cooling effects. So carbon dioxide is released through lots of different processes that we have benefited from. Energy production, you know, whether you're burning coal or natural gas to produce energy, releases carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. And the more carbon dioxide that's in the atmosphere, the more heat that can be trapped in the atmosphere and lead to warming. It also comes from transportation. So, you know, cars, internal combustion engine cars, produce a small amount of carbon dioxide. When you scale that up globally, it's a significant part, as well as aircraft produce, you know, when they're burning oil and fuel, they're producing carbon dioxide as well. And then agriculture supplies carbon dioxide. There's lots of different other sources that, you know, we benefit from, we live off of, but ultimately can cause a change in the atmosphere that then can change the climate.
I'm curious now. Ryan, how do you heat your home?
I have a wood stove.
Okay.
I do. If that doesn't provide enough heat, then I will turn on electric heat.
Okay. What are some other measures you have personally undertaken because of your beliefs?
I do try to reduce my footprint as much as possible. I do feel like...
A footprint, you know?
My carbon emissions, how much greenhouse gases I'm personally emitting.
Okay.
So I don't eat red meat. Red meat is...
Whoa. I had not heard this part.
Oh, yeah.
Eating red meat is help me.
It can have carbon emissions associated with it. In terms of all different meat that you might consume, a lot of energy goes into cattle, especially because they're larger animals. They require more agriculture for them to grow, for you to get them to a large enough size that you may then consume. And so there's a lot of more emissions associated in the indirect kind of things that you don't think about, like growing and raising the cattle, sustaining the cattle. That would then lead to the food that you get from it. That's a personal one. I mean, I have a solar grid at my house. So I have a solar array that produces all of my energy in the summer and about half of it, depending on how cloudy it is in the winter. I drive a fully electric vehicle that I charge with my solar array or charge at the library, which also has a solar array. So those are things that, you know, reduce my transportation emissions significantly, especially since my car is charged on renewable energy and not, you know, energy produced by coal or natural gas.
Right.
So those are some of the bigger things that I do.
And a wish for thing you would like to do, something you still have in the back of your mind you'd like to do to, again, improve this footprint.
I wish that, you know, larger corporations, so I love the idea of, you know, individuals taking action and reducing their own footprint, but I ultimately believe this is not a problem of individuals. It's a problem of larger entities that are relying on greenhouse gases. And my wish would be that those would find alternate means to do their work and find ways that are more sustainable, because ultimately, you know, oil, natural gas, coal are limited resources. There's not an infinite amount of that supply. So moving to a renewable source that has a less environmental impact would be my wish, because then we'd see a bigger change globally in terms of emissions. So, you know, and making our voice heard, talking to people like we're doing here to get the word out more, voting for people that hold the same environmental views as you do, so that they may have a voice in places where decisions are made and laws are passed that may help to promote change that you want to see as well, because an individual can only do so much, but elected officials may have the power in a collective to make more progressive change on that topic, if that's something that you're passionate about as well.
Has the government taken, and it could be a state level, it could be a local level, it could be a federal level, have they taken any steps to encourage people to be more responsible in terms of energy? I'll leave it at that.
Yeah, absolutely. So when I purchased my solar array, there was a federal program that I got 25% of that cost back. So it's an incentive to buy solar that you're only paying effectively 75% of the cost, and 25% comes back to you in a tax return on your taxes. There's similar things that exist for certain electrical vehicles, so you can get incentives to buy those. If they're a newer electric vehicle, they haven't sold very many, you can get a certain return as well. There's a lot of other federal programs for incentives to adapt to energy efficient appliances, and you can get credit back on your taxes as well for that. So there are these local incentives or these federal incentives that exist, and not everyone knows about them. You should check into them if you're interested. It can help you adapt to some of these changes if you're interested in making them. As a nation, I will say that, you know, we are part of the International Paris Climate Agreement, which is an international legislation, a law that is working to have each country do their part in reducing their emissions and leading to a more sustainable future. So we're part of that now, and we need to make a lot of progress into reaching our goals and targets in that, but it's a step in the right direction.
It seems to me that I've heard about the expression climate change quite a bit, particularly in the last 5 or 6 years. Is that happening?
Yeah.
And how severe is it, and how worrisome is it?
So, yeah, I'm worried about it. Okay. I think about it, I'm sure, much more than the average person. It's something that I think about pretty much every day. And the main reason why is I have two daughters that, you know, one's in high school, one's in middle school. And I worry about their future and what kind of world they may have in that future. And so a lot of my interests in climate change are about what could their future look like. And yeah, I want them to have the same kind of future that I've, you know, lived in this, in terms of this earth. So it comes on a personal level for me. And I think a lot of people can relate to that, you know, wanting the world to be a good place for the future generations that they're connected to. We've seen an upward trend in temperatures. We've seen an upward trend in greenhouse gas emissions. That may be leveling off, which gives me some hope. If that goes down, then we can see some changes in the longer term with that. But it is very, very concerning. And the scary news is our window to act on this in a way to avoid some of the most catastrophic damages and loss is getting quicker and shorter. So we have, you know, less time to avoid some of the larger changes that we think would happen at 1.5 degrees Celsius of warming up to 2 degrees Celsius warming.
We have many students involved in your program. What about the community? Are there organizations, an organization that whereby community people who find this topic of interest and would like to do their part to better things could get involved and learn and also perhaps share their information with their friends?
Yeah, I'll plug in Rural Action. I mean, Rural Action does a lot of great work on various topics. I think they're all related to sustainability in some way. And so whether it's like waste reduction or environmental education, sustainable agriculture, they have so many programs that are so great in this area. And so getting involved in those things, you may not realize them as working to reduce climate change, but ultimately they're working to build a sustainable future. I would say they're a fantastic organization. But really, I mean, you can think about like the Sierra Club, the Sierra Coalition. That's a large international organization that does a lot of environmental movements. 350.org is another one at the national scale that does a lot in terms of lobbying and policy work. So those are great organizations. On campus, I am fortunate in my spare time and part time to work in the Office of Sustainability at Ohio University. And I lead a group there called the Climate and Sustainability Ambassadors. We do lots of different things on and off campus to promote sustainability and climate literacy and climate action. One of the things we do in the spring is go into the schools and talk to students about climate change.
This is maybe a lousy example. Years ago, there was a thing called, Tom Kastoris started it, and it was, what was the nickname for it? Anyway, Eating Healthy. And I took the course. It was fascinating. My wife did too. And it's not that we changed our eating habits, but we sure modified them. if there were something to encourage people to be aware and educated on these topics, and maybe they would take some steps to improve the use of energy, the effects on the environment. I just noticed we have 1 minute left. I would think it'd be cool if you guys did that.
Yeah. I think one of the simple things people can do is not even have to
change. Oh, it was called the CHIP program.
I was wondering if that's what it was.
Yeah.
So reducing food waste. You don't have to change your diet and become vegetarian or vegan or even cut out red meat like I've done. But food waste, a group called Project Drawdown says that's one of the biggest things that people can do on an individual scale that could have a global impact if you worked on reducing your food waste. And the main reason why is there's so many emissions associated with food, getting it from the farm to the market, getting it from your market to your home, even in the production of the food, there's a lot of emissions associated. And if you are just simply throwing that food out and not consuming it, all of those emissions have no benefit. And so reducing the amount of food that you throw out would not only save you money, so it's a smart economical decision for you personally, it would also reduce the emissions that are associated with that food. So just reducing your food waste and being mindful of what you can do to shop wisely and not buy more food than you're going to consume, and ways that you can preserve food or eat leftovers for foods that you have after a meal.
Ryan Foote, our guest, I think we're going to have him back because this is such an important topic and so many different angles to consider. And I'll make sure I have an order of beef liver for you when you return. I'm kidding, of course. Folks, have a safe day out there, please. We'll see you all over again tomorrow.
73rd year of serving Southeast Ohio. AM 970 and 97.